This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechemir.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, finding buried treasure and putting it back. We'll look inside caves for clues to the past and put one major clue back in place, a body from On Your Knees Cave, plus searching for gold and getting fooled.
Well, it does look like gold if you don't know what you're looking for.
That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Jessica Cochran. It's always exciting to find something that has been buried a long time. You know the feeling. Maybe you uncover an old toy, a Kennedy-era dime, or a broken coffee cup. You stuff it in your pocket, show it to someone, put it somewhere special to look at later. Usually, these things somehow get lost again. And because they were moved, they've lost their context. That silver Kennedy dime has no business being in a supermarket cash register, mixed in with the modern alloy coins. But every now and then, you stumble on a treasure so significant, it raises the stakes. Jay Marble explains.
As treasures go, this was a doozy. In 1993, Rhodes surveyors found an interesting cave with bear bones inside. This attracted paleontologist and professor Tim Heaton from the University of South Dakota. He'd been looking at Southeast Alaska caves and found lots of them with animal remains, but none this old. He wanted something that would reveal what was going on during the last ice age and maybe before that. In this cave, he found thousands of bones. Among other things, he learned that 40,000 years ago, brown and black bears lived on Prince of Wales Island.
And so it was, at least then in the transition to the modern condition, it was probably the development of the forest favored the black bears, and the brown bears eventually bit the dust here where they thrived elsewhere.
Heaton has looked all over Southeast for another On Your Knees cave, caves with a south-facing slope, which would be warmer even during the Ice Age, close but not too close to sea level. But he's never found one with the same continuous animal record. He suspects the foxes were dragging these animals in and burying them. One of Heaton's favorite animals in the cave is the ring seal.
These seals that only live on sea ice and are now confined away up in the Arctic were found in quite great abundance in On Your Knees Cave, and they all date between 13 and 24,000 years ago.
So one treasure that the little nondescript cave gave up to Heaton was an animal record of life during severe climate changes that included ice ages, rising and falling sea levels, the compressing and rebounding of the earth, and the transition to the current forest ecology. But it gave up even more. While Heaton was looking for animal bones, he turned up human remains. That required a different kind of researcher. Jim Dixon is the director of the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology and a professor of anthropology at the University of New Mexico. While he and others were in that cave, they found some really shiny treasure, about 40 obsidian rock chips. Tests show these came not from Prince of Wales, but from Sumez Island and Mount Edziza, which is up the Stikine River in British Columbia. Somebody had to have carried them to this cave, and that would have involved water travel. Here's Dixon.
It inferentially demonstrates the use of watercraft. We wouldn't certainly find watercraft preserved archaeologically. It's very difficult to find ancient watercraft preserved archaeologically. But the fact that this site occurs on an island with these exotic types of rock traded to the island or transported to the island shows that people clearly had watercraft of some type, probably boats.
Scientists also determined that the man inside the cave ate sea mammals. Combine that with the island location and rocks from other places, and a very different picture of what humans were doing and where they were doing it emerges. Terry Fifield is the Forest Service archaeologist on Prince of Wales Island.
What this tells us is that people very early on, 10,300 years ago, were on the coast, and that the coastal habitat was there that would have supported human occupation several thousand years before that. So it gives us reasons to look harder at that coastal migration theory of for peopling of the Americas.
So a lot of treasure came from the cave. But after all the digging and all the tests, somebody had to deal with the actual person who was found. The Kluak and Craig tribal governments on Prince of Wales asked for the remains to be transferred to them. Their request met the requirements of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act because the remains are considered Native American and they were found on the ancestral land of the Tlingit. Now, instead of treasures coming from the cave, it started going the other way. The 10,000-year-old man was given a name, Shukaka. 2 days of ceremonies marked his return. Dennis Nickerson of the Kluak Cooperative Association coordinated the activities surrounding the return. He says he's aware of discussions about exactly whose relative this person is.
We've came across that, you know, should we call him a Tlingit, should we call him a Haida, you know, and whatnot, but you know, whether or not he is or isn't, you know, we're welcoming him with open arms and on our land, you know, and we've always been like that. You know, we've never disrespected visitors before, you know, whether or not his blood lineage shows he's Tlingit, Haida, Native American, you know, he's a visitor and that's what we're welcoming him as. Yeah, with the highest respect.
Shukaka was placed in a carved bent wood box, which was wrapped in a woven blanket. He was also given a headstone, and he was put back in the ground during a private ceremony. Bob Sam from Sitka is a caretaker of ancient sites, including cemeteries and graves. He says after the headstone was placed and offerings of tobacco were made, Sam was left alone at the gravesite.
I set up the place where it looks very natural so that I ask nature to take care of this place because it's really nature that takes care of places like this much better than we do.
In all the years the On Your Knees Cave Project went on, there was a stream of researchers, students, dignitaries, and reporters who visited the cave, went inside it. Boats and helicopters brought in supplies. The location was an open secret. Now, there are federal laws about messing around with these kinds of places, but when it comes to Shukaka's resting place, it gets down to something very basic, something we do all the time when it comes to treasure. You forget about it. I'm Jay Marble.
In the Aleutians, archaeologists have collected prehistoric artifacts for close to a century. Some say they know all they need to about the Aleut culture that dates back 9,000 years. Others say they've only scratched and plundered the surface. Ann Hillman explored some of the sites with regional archaeologists.
Deep in the Aleutians is a small cave littered with bits of wood, rotting grasses, old fox droppings, and pieces of bone. It looks completely unremarkable, unless you're an archaeologist.
Oh my God! This is. Do you know what this is?
What?
It's a baby cradle part. This is the bottom piece. And the supports that go up the back and out the front this way, this is where they peg in. And this is that bottom right here. So the little baby's fanny is going to sit about right here.
Alaskan archaeologist Allison McLean explores the debris-like artifacts with U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist Deborah Corbett. They're examining an Aleut burial site with objects dating between 1,000 and 200 years ago. Most of the bodies, tools, grass mats, and other sexy artifacts were taken in the 1930s by a group led by Smithsonian archaeologist Alice Herlishka.
Basically, they did a fine scientific job of plundering an irreplaceable cemetery.
Corbett explains that in 2 days, they boxed up remains from 194 bodies, including 72 mummies, and all of the sewing kits, hunting tools, knives, and objects of everyday life that accompanied them. But the archaeologist didn't record many notes about where the objects were located in relationship to each other. Corbett says, out of context, it's harder to tell what it all meant.
It's like taking a book and cutting out all the pictures in the book and then looking at the pictures and trying to understand what that book is telling you. You've got the cool stuff, but you don't really have the story that goes with those pictures.
Over the past few years, McLean has worked with Unungan, or Aleut, colleagues at the Aleutians Pribilof Islands Association to try to recreate that story and repatriate the knowledge of the Unungan peoples. She says much can be learned from something as simple as a sewing kit with dyed sinew and guts.
And it's just an incredible story about this woman's skill, this sewing skill that makes waterproof seams, that creates garments that not only are aesthetically astoundingly beautiful, but keep people alive on the open ocean.
But she's only just beginning her research. It's hard to access Smithsonian collections when she's based in Anchorage. Because of the limited information, the only things that archaeologists know for certain about the people of the islands of the Four Mountains are that, unlike other groups in the region, they hunted whales and they mummified their dead.
Reports from the Russians, reports from other anthropologists, reports by the Aleuts indicate that the people in the islands of the Four Mountains were somehow different than those on Umnak and Unalaska. And different is always a little dangerous, a little scary, and the Unalaskans and Umnak Aleuts enlisted Russian help to put an end to that danger.
Corbett says she thinks the Four Mountains tribe was different because of the geology of the islands they lived on. The small, steep volcanoes didn't have much shallow water near them, so it was harder to catch fish. Instead, the people developed strong kayaks and hunted whales. Evidence of this lies in the wooden kayak parts and whale bones scattered in the ancient burial sites. But McLean says, at this point, the sites themselves won't tell us anything more.
The few pieces that we saw there are all incredibly represented in museum collections. There's no reason to go back and conduct any sort of scientific investigation of these places. We know what's come out of them.
And Corbett says, now they know what has not come out of them.
There does not seem to be a lot of visitation or a lot of damage, recent damage to those caves, which is very encouraging and gives us hope that the isolation and the difficulty of access will continue to protect those sites.
And to protect the sacred burials of the Aleut dead. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman.
Coming up after the break, an unwelcome surprise from underwater.
There's some fuel that has released and is now pooling in the ceiling of the galley in the dining saloon.
Stay with us. Welcome back to AK. Sometimes digging around in the garden can yield surprising results. Socket wrenches, interesting stones, an old dog bone or two. But one summer a few years ago, AK's Ellen Lockyer found something that totally blew her mind.
It was a year or three after I'd moved into my new house in Midtown Anchorage. It had a yard full of junk when I bought it, half an acre of old car parts, tires, and a couple of truck engines that people told me actually still worked. But I saw what it could be, a veritable gardener's paradise, and I set myself to making it look that way. It took a couple of years to get the junk hauled off. After that, I began putting in flower beds, but one thing stood in my way, a giant of a false Ural spirea that choked up a shaded, protected area that would be perfect for my wild blue flags and cranesbills. Digging out the roots was a chore, but I persevered, then started digging down to remove the big rocks underneath. I sweated in the July heat. Remember warm summers? And dug till I hit something really solid. I could hear the shovel blade scraping against something, but the object would not budge. I hit it again and again, metal ringing against whatever it was, and finally got down on my knees and dug it out all the way with my hands. The instant I saw it, I knew what it was. I had seen them in movies and cartoons. Its pineapple shape was quite familiar, but I still couldn't believe it. I held it up and asked my World War II vintage next-door neighbor Emery if he was thinking what I was thinking. "Yep," Emery said, "it's a hand grenade." I called the police, and taking no chances, they sent the bomb squad. It was a very big deal. Even local TV reporters came by for an interview with the lady who had found a hand grenade in her garden. It turned out that there was no ordnance inside, and the bomb squad went home, taking the grenade with them. My neighbor remembered that once, years ago, some National Guard guys, he said, had rented my house. They could have left it there, along with the junk car parts. So you never know what lurks beneath. I was lucky. It could have been loaded. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The military left plenty of dubious treasure, buried and unburied, on land and sea, but they're not the only ones. Hidden beneath Alaska's coastal waters are the stuff of legends and folklore. Shipwrecks. Just the word conjures images of the skeletons of doomed explorers and chests filled with riches. But a reality show about shipwrecks would not be nearly so glamorous, because in reality, much of the cargo still on board is hazardous. Lori Townsend has more.
Some wrecks contain hazards nearly beyond belief, like Dan Magone's favorite story. He's a marine salvage expert out of Dutch Harbor, and he says during the 60s, the U.S. Navy filled an old vessel with World War II-era ordnance.
You know, like mines and torpedoes and bombs and whatever. And they filled the ship up with it. I can't remember how many thousand tons of this stuff. And then they towed it out someplace where they knew nobody would care, which was the Aleutians.
They put a pressure-sensitive detonator on it, planning for it to explode when it sank to a certain depth. Only it didn't quite work out that way.
They cut it loose, and it disappeared into the fog, and it never blew up.
They reluctantly went looking for it, but didn't want to touch it.
So they brought in planes, and they bombed it to try to get it to blow up, because it didn't sink where it was supposed to. It had drifted into shallow water. And so they tried bombing it from the air a number of times, and that didn't work. So then they decided that it was safe.
Magone says the Navy publication he read didn't say where it is. He speculates that it's still classified.
So as far as the hazmat cargo that's sunk in Alaskan waters, I'd probably put that one somewhere near the top.
But military shenanigans aside, there are vessels in Alaskan waters that contain hazards that are all too common. Heavy fuel, possibly a lot of it, is still laying on the ocean bottom in the tanks of numerous wrecks.
This is a teacup from the Alaska Steamship Company. It has the logo of the steamship line on the front. And it's white with a kind of a blue-green accent.
Anchorage diver Steve Lloyd found the Aleutian in the summer of 2002. The vessel was virtually forgotten for 73 years, lying in Uyak Bay near Kodiak. The steamship sank in about 200 feet of water in 1929. Beyond coffee cups, compasses, and a bell from the steamer's bow, Lloyd and his partners also saw evidence of fuel still on the massive vessel. The ship could hold more than 400 passengers and up to 150 crew members. He says it would have been the practice back then to fuel up in Seattle.
Estimates are that it was probably between one-half and two-thirds full, which would have equaled perhaps as much as 150 to 175,000 gallons.
Lloyd says over the course of three summers, he and his dive partners saw evidence that fuel was leaking from the deteriorating tanks. He traces his finger over the area on a drawing of the vessel's structure.
There's the galley, and here's a fuel oil bunker just below it. So that suggests to us that what has happened, at least in the case of the, I believe that's the number two bunker tank, but at any rate, there's some fuel that has released probably from this tank or from this tank and has managed to go up two decks and is now pooling in the ceiling of the galley in the dining saloon.
After Lloyd and his partners formed a company to take others on dive tours of the Aleutian, the state suddenly wanted to claim ownership and used Lloyd's own information about the possibility of a fuel discharge from the decrepit tanks in court. The state said if Lloyd's crew were at the site and fuel dumped into the ocean, they would be responsible for potentially millions in cleanup costs. Lloyd says he hasn't returned to the site since the case, but he's surprised that in 4 years, state officials haven't taken any action.
As a resident of Alaska, I can't believe that there isn't someone at some level of state government whose job it is to pay attention to this stuff.
When these shipwrecks are as old as this one, it's somewhat of a gray area.
Gary Folley works for the State Department of Environmental Conservation. He says the procedure for a ship that runs aground today is clear. Work with the Coast Guard, refloat the vessel, contain any spill, and remove the fuel. But it's not so clear in the case of a vessel that has been on the bottom for years.
There are literally hundreds of these shipwrecks throughout Alaskan waters, including 238 in the Kodiak area, and also As a result of World War II actions, Kiska seems to be a popular place.
Folly says removing oil from submerged wrecks, especially thick bunker C fuel, requires divers and equipment to drill into the tanks, heat the fuel to re-liquefy it, and suction it out. A similar effort near San Francisco cost $23 million. He says the state of Alaska has options available if a wreck needs attention, but it would be a tough sell in the case of the Aleutian.
We would have to make a determination and show that the risk of a spill, the threat to the environment or the public health and welfare is both substantial and imminent. And with the wreck this old and not actively leaking, it's difficult to make that argument.
Anchorage diver Steve Lloyd is unconvinced. He says even now, the Aleutian is crumbling into the ocean floor.
If through the state's inattention and inaction, the wreck is allowed to continue to deteriorate to the point where the oil is spontaneously released, it's going to be a major ecological nightmare, I don't believe is too strong a word. It depends how much is there. It could be a little bit, which would just be an icky mess and kill a few birds, or it could be a heck of a lot and completely foul Uyak Bay and the northwest coast of Kodiak Island.
Marine environmental experts estimate there are 8,000 large vessels sunk in coastal waters worldwide that have the potential to release significant amounts of old fuel. Many of these vessels are World War II era ships, now about 60 years old, and probably suffering significant corrosion. For AK, I'm Lori Townsend.
Time now for our trip around the state. On this week's segment of 300 Villages, we'll head to Good News Bay on the southwest coast and Kenny Lake, not far from Glen Allen, on the road to Chitna and McCarthy.
My name is George Sprite Sr., and I'm from Good News Bay. And I currently work as a village public safety officer. Good News Bay is located southwest coastal area between Bethel and Dillingham. Population of Good News Bay is approximate at about 300 people. From what the older people tell me, they had a miner by the name of Joseph Jean, and his wife had a baby, and he came out of his house and he said, "I have good news, it's a boy." So it's like Good News Bay stuck. In the past, we had, like, before Good News became a little village, we had, like, you know, families living up in separate places, like upriver, down along the coastline. So they weren't gathered in the village of Good News until, I'm going to estimate, maybe mid-20s or 30s when the cannery was built. There are many challenges here. Mostly elderly people, they depend on their Social Security. And the prices of heating fuel and gas, along with the local community store that sells food items, they're outrageously high.
My name is Carl Crosman. I live in Kenny Lake, Alaska, and my wife and I have a small bed and bath. The population of Kenny Lake is around 400 to 600, I would say, just roughly. A lot of the people here are work farming, and a major portion of the people just have a subsistence lifestyle. You have a few government jobs scattered in and out of there, but Kenny Lake itself does not have a real economy, so to speak. The Copper River red salmon in the summertime, we dip net out of the Copper River, and then you have subsistence hunting here consisting of caribou, moose, bear, although that's not my particular choice, and various birds. We are a flyway for migration back and forth, so you can get a pretty varied diet around here, just living a subsistence lifestyle.
We heard from George Bright Sr. in Good News Bay and Carl Crossman in Kenny Lake. In Juneau, an old wooden flume known as the Treadwell Ditch is still mostly buried on the mountainous flanks of Douglas Island. It took some 20 years to build, between 1880 and 1900, and provided a steady flow of water for mechanical and hydroelectric power to the Treadwell Mining Complex, at the time the largest gold mining operation in the world. The 14-mile ditch has high historic value, but the long, flat trail beside it also has a lot of recreation value. The question is how to mix recreation with historical preservation. Scott Burton has more.
The Treadwell Ditch has been a favorite hike of mine for many years.
30-year Douglas resident Frances Still and her dog Echo are hiking up the 500 or so feet to get on the bottom end of the ditch trail.
I really love looking at the historical aspect of it. It's a beautiful walk through the woods, and besides that, it's an example of a tremendous amount of human effort that went into building it back in the late 1800s.
That may have all been by hand, though some think machines were involved, and there are rumors of Chinese labor.
Look, we're on the Treadwell Ditch. It's covered with spruce needles. It's soft. It's a nice little trail through the woods. And we can see the remains of the Treadwell Ditch and the covering logs that they put over it, all covered with moss now.
Still is standing on the small berm that was created along the flume as it was dug out. Here the ditch is about 5 feet wide and 3 feet deep. The moss-covered top kept debris out and prevented the water from freezing in winter. In its prime, it began up near Eagle Crest Ski Area at 950 feet, and like a rain gutter around the island, collected water from creeks and streams as it descended at less than a 1% slope to its destination above the Treadwell Mine. Now, the nearly flat trail originally used for maintenance is great for hiking, except where it's been washed out in several places.
Here we are at Lawson Creek, and it's a big creek. You're not going to cross it without getting your feet wet unless you got rubber boots, and you better have your rubber boots all the way up.
Perfect world for you. What would you see here?
I'd see a nice bridge. It's going to have to be a big, sturdy bridge because I think Lawson Creek gets real full at times. And it's, in my opinion, the one thing that really needs to be done on this section of the trail.
Still was one of dozens of people who testified at recent hearings about the trail's future. She wants the trail to stay mostly the same. Much of it is single track, only a foot and a half wide, with moss and trees encroaching from all sides. She'd like to have the bridges fixed so hikers can use the full trail, but not much else. While some at the hearings agreed with historic preservation, others would like to see it more aggressively developed.
We're here today to talk about the Treadwell Ditch Trail, which is something that's been going on for many years.
I think this is a golden opportunity for a place to have a green trail, and I would like to see the trail built to a width wide enough to accommodate a snow machine and grooming equipment. Ideally, a narrow skating lane. If the funds aren't available, a narrower lane that's wide enough for a snow machine to tow grooming equipment and a diagonal track set.
The meeting was run by Trail Mix, a nonprofit that coordinates trail planning and construction. Board member Mark Wilkie is a 30-year resident of Alaska and a snowmobiler. He thinks the trail can be developed for more than just hikers while preserving the historical integrity.
I think there's enough room to do both, to preserve parts of the trail in its natural state, and portions of that trail can then be developed into a more of a recreational use.
Wilkie suggests a third of the trail be highly developed for activities like snowmobiling, a third left undeveloped, close to its current state, and the remainder somewhere in the middle. He'd also like to see a portion of the ditch renovated and signed as an example of its original state. He says that adjusting a site with historical significance to facilitate recreation is common.
Almost without exception, every hiking trail in the Juneau area is a former mine trail. Some of them are on old railroad right-of-ways. Some of them are on old horse tram right-of-ways. Some of them were just flat-out roads. So it's not unusual in this community for us to have taken this historic trail, developed it, turned it into something new as a recreational asset.
But for Francis Still, it's more of an asset the way it is now. And if it changes too much?
Well, I probably wouldn't hike it as much, but I really think that the trail can be changed slightly and made very accessible to a lot of people.
Trail Mix is compiling comments from the neighborhood meetings and will continue to search for funding and work on permitting to begin renovating the ditch trail. For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
After the break, making the film Red Gold.
These people love the fishery and they love the lifestyle.
That's ahead. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Jessica Cochran, and this week we're talking about buried treasure. Now, in these troubled financial times, there's one thing you can count on. Gold. At the current price of about $900 an ounce, gold is still bedrock in a shaky world economy, financial analysts claim. But as the saying goes, all that glitters is not gold, and some treasure seekers are tricked time and time again by appearances, whether it's knockoff Gucci bags, faux jewelry, or fool's gold. AK's Ellen Lockyer has more.
In the romantic comedy Fool's Gold, treasure seekers portrayed by Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson risk life and limb.
If we don't go after that treasure, it's going to haunt us the rest of our lives, and you know it.
It's $500 million.
For treasure beyond their wildest dreams. Gold and precious gems like emeralds and rubies, not to mention diamonds, maintain their value despite a crashing stock market.
Kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend.
That's the inimitable Marilyn Monroe singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. Not such a joke these days. We may all soon be reduced to bartering whatever we can grow, raise, or dig up out of the ground. Mineral wealth in one form or another has lured treasure seekers since history began. And according to geologist Janine Schmidt, it's scarcity that makes any mineral valuable. And the reverse is true, too. Take worthless pyrite, for example.
It's the most common sulfide mineral on the Earth. It occurs in pretty much 50% or more of every rock on the planet.
Now, the image of the lone prospector with his pick and his gold pan is written across Alaska's history in indelible ink. A few of the old-time gold seekers did strike it rich, but most of them went home empty-handed. And an unfortunate few may have thought they had found a fortune until they brought their haul to the assayer's office.
When you're panning for gold, which was the normal way that old-time prospectors would, you're basically taking a sediment out of a stream and you're using the action of the water to float off all the light minerals like silicates and things like that. And what you're left with is what's called the heavies. And these include a variety of things, oxides like magnetite. And because you're looking at tiny, tiny grains, it's much easier to mistake the color of pyrite.
Schmidt works for the U.S. Geological Survey, as does her colleague, geologist Dwight Bradley.
I'm holding up a little vial of, it's a mixture of gold and pyrite from the Congo. Under the microscope, you can clearly tell the difference, but with the naked eye, they pretty much look alike. But when you're dealing with a flake, you could never detect the difference.
Pyrite is often confused with gold because of its brassy yellow color.
In certain gold deposits, the gold is really tiny, and it occurs inside pyrite crystals. So yes, sometimes pyrite is, it's fool's gold, but it has gold, real gold in it.
But unlike gold, pyrite is hard and brittle. It is known to be associated with the presence of gold or copper, so sometimes locating fool's gold means the real thing is around someplace.
We're looking at two different minerals here. The rock I'm holding is about 4 inches long, 2 inches wide, and it's got a surface that's been cut by a rock saw, so you can see it quite well. And there's one big chunk of pyrite that's about an inch long, and it's got a brassy color. And near it are a bunch of smaller blebs of chalcopyrite, which is a cousin of pyrite. And the chalcopyrite here looks much more like gold than the pyrite does.
If pyrite is so common and is found everywhere, why do so many people get fooled by it?
Well, it does look like gold if you don't know what you're looking for.
Schmidt hands me a tiny nugget of pyrite, and Bradley gives me a powerful magnifying glass.
There'll be little striations on the surface of the crystal that you can see.
Huh. Well, see, I would think that was gold
okay,
if I
so
saw that.
So do you know how to look through
one
of these? Put it up to where it's about touching your eyelashes,
you
and then you hold
finger.
The mineral.
Oh, just, there it is.
Yeah, there you go. And then you...
Oh, look how pretty that is. It is beautiful. I could see where people would think it was gold.
Some pyrite is used in jewelry. Semi-precious malachite is actually pyrite. At one time, pyrite was mined for its sulfur content, although that is no longer the case. Bradley says other things have changed, too. Now people are prospecting for rocks from outer space.
And the most common thing that people bring in is what they think are meteorites that aren't meteorites because they're so valuable. They want to have found a meteorite. So anything that looks kind of gnarly.
Prospecting for tangible mineral wealth, like gold or space rocks for that matter, is tricky, and it's easy to get fooled. But with the stock market crashing with the speed of a meteor plunging to Earth, the fool's gold of paper investments gives new meaning to an old cliché. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaskans are deeply divided about many issues that deal with the state's natural treasures. How best to develop or not to develop the state's vast natural resources surfaces in almost every election. This year, ballot measure 4 would have impacted development of the Pebble Mine in western Alaska, but it was voted down. A documentary film that won top honors at the Telluride Mountain Film Festival hopes to educate those outside of the state about the Pebble Mine and the controversy surrounding it. AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock spoke with the producers of the film, Red Gold.
Travis Rummel loves to fish, so when he started making films, it was a no-brainer to combine his two loves together. He and his partner, Ben Knight, broke into the film industry initially by making short conservation-based fly fishing films under the company name Felt Soul Media.
Everybody in the lower 48 knows Bristol Bay, and it's kind of the mecca of sport fishing in the U.S. So when we felt like it was threatened, it seemed like very good material to do a documentary film. So we originally approached it in the vein of just strictly sport fishing conservation, and as we did more research and spent time in the area, we just learned that it was such a bigger story than that.
The filmmakers partnered with Trout Unlimited and spent 10 weeks filming in Alaska. Rummel says they wanted to tell a balanced story from the beginning, but he also says they knew they were going to tell it from the perspective of the fishermen, who were worried about what the mine would do to their lifestyle. So it was hard to find that same kind of passion among supporters of the Pebble Mine project.
It really comes across evidently in the film that these people love the fishery and they love the lifestyle. And then kind of alternatively, the most passionate people that spoke for the mine were the geologists, and that's kind of their profession. And that comes across really clearly in the film as well, that for them, this is the pinnacle of their career. This is one of the largest copper sulfide deposits ever found anywhere in the world. And for them, their eyes light up.
In some places, you just have to say no, that the risks are too high, that we can't engineer, we can't mitigate our way out of the mess that we're about to create.
What do we got to think? We got to conquer everything and kill it and destroy it and beat it to death?
Open pit mining ruins watersheds.
There's never been a mine of this size and this type that's ever been built in such sensitive fish habitat.
There is a conventional wisdom that ecosystems are fragile, and conventional wisdom, in my experience, is typically conventional, but not always wise.
Ellen Frankenstein, whose self-proclaimed title is a sometimes employed filmmaker in Sitka, says for her, the interviews with the geologist were the best part of the film.
You know, scientists, they love to discover things, but that doesn't mean they understand what that discovery means. And the way the filmmakers captured him was it just really showed that. I mean, they were just excited to find the material.
Rummel says even local residents who work for Northern Dynasty, the corporation behind the open pit Pebble Mine, did not want to be interviewed or be in the film. And he says he was surprised that Alaskans who have seen the film weren't more critical about outsiders telling this story. But Frankenstein says who tells the story isn't really that important. although she says other filmmakers are always going to watch a documentary with an editor's eye.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful film, man. It was gorgeous to watch. I just felt, as a filmmaker, I mean, and again, everyone can undo and redo anyone else's films, and mine certainly need to be destroyed. But what I really noticed is that they sort of fell in love with a couple characters, so it's hard for them to kind of not dwell on them.
Frankenstein says it's a challenge to represent a topic as huge as this in one film. Travis Rummel thinks by the time they previewed Red, Gold, and Alaska, Alaskans had already made up their minds whether they support the mine or not. And that was quickly realized by defeat of Ballot Measure 4, which would have prohibited new mines from discharging pollutants that would harm salmon or humans. Audiences in the lower 48 had a different reaction. Besides winning the Editor's Choice Award at the Telluride Mountain Film Festival, Rummel says they had sold out crowds two nights in a row and were turning people away.
Go down to the lower 48, and even if people have heard of Bristol Bay, chances are they haven't heard about the Pebble Mine. So for us, the whole impetus to create the film was to kind of create a national conversation and get people aware of what's at stake and that it is actually a choice and it will be decided.
Red Gold has aired in about 7 cities in Alaska now, but chances are it will have larger audiences when it's shown in D.C., New York, and San Francisco. It will also have a 40-city run in the U.K. and Europe. Rummel says he would like to see the Pebble Mine get the kind of national attention that drilling in Anwar has received. Alaska's congressional delegation has long supported drilling in Anwar, but most have expressed concern over the Pebble Mine and its location at the headwaters of the state's lucrative salmon runs. Even U.S. Senator Ted Stevens has said he is very disturbed by the project. And Democratic challenger for Senator Stevens' seat, Mark Begich, says while he also supports drilling in Anwar, he doesn't support the Pebble Mine.
I don't think Pebble Mine can do as they have laid out. They've described it as they can develop that mine in an environmentally sound way. I don't believe they can at this point. They have not shown that evidence, and they have not been supportive. I've talked to the Dillingham folks, for example, recently and said the same thing, that I think they have a long haul. They're trying to do a 200-300-year mine project in 40, 50 years, and that's just going to be damaging long-term.
Let us finish investing our hundreds of millions of dollars on the studies and the project design, present that empirical data to the agencies and to the public and all the stakeholders, and let the data speak for itself.
There will likely be a lot more discussion about the Pebble Mine project as the issues are debated in the upcoming election. And on a national and even international level, Felt Soul Media hopes its film, Red Gold, will help make this particular conversation a lot more global. For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Oh, I wish I were a real Alaskan girl. I wish that I could hold my beer. I would wear.
So there's a girl, a young woman, I should say, who's been around APRN for several years now. She worked for AK, editing 300 Villages tape. She answers phones for Talk of Alaska. She does graphic design. But it turns out there's also a singer-songwriter buried within her, and in the last year or so, she's let that treasure out. Marianne Call is currently on tour in Canada, Seattle, L.A., and points in between. Call told APRN's Lori Townsend she renovated an old bus for the trip.
We found several buses on Craigslist, actually, most of them already converted, but we picked what we thought was the nicest one. We brought it home. We've done a bunch of work on it. It was a beautiful conversion, and we've just done some improvements. But it's got wood floors. It's got wood walls, real interior, a nice structure, kind of like a train. It's got my own recording studio, and it's a pretty nifty bus. We're buying a fireplace for it right now. So we're not so much hippies as city slickers in a bus, just because it happens to be convenient to our way of life.
How many people are traveling with you?
That depends on which show. In LA, we'll probably take as much of a band as we can, because we know we have a really big gig when we arrive. But other shows, I may just take a guitarist, or I may just really practice my piano hard and try and go myself. It's interesting that I always have to take an accompanist with me wherever I go. I just don't sing very well when I have to focus on playing an instrument as well. And I also kind of like the fact that I'm dependent on other musicians. It keeps me from getting into musical ruts that I would get into if I played everything for myself. Having different people interpret what I'm doing all the time and having to change it up to fit different musicians. Still, I would love to have a steady band someday.
What are some of the songs that stand out to you that you're going to be releasing soon?
Well, I'll start with a few I've already released because I just actually, my first album was very recent still. I just released it, about a year ago? Not even that. And I've only started really getting distribution in the last 3 months. It's called Vanilla, and it was written here kind of about my experiences feeling rather isolated from my music community in Alaska. And about my experiences arriving in Alaska and finding that a lot of the things that I thought mattered outside didn't matter so much up here. And I actually have fallen in love with that environment, really. One, two, three. A nicely balanced budget's not so thrilling. And courtesy's outdated and sobriety is lame. Reliability is not appealing. But I don't know any other way to be. I love people and I want them to love me. My virtues are vanilla at best, but you can always call on. Then just for fun and to get better at the recording process and at the writing process, because I wanted to get faster at it and be less terrified of approaching the creative process. So I started a song a month project last November, and I recorded a song every month at home, and I think I did one or two in the studio, but for the most part they were all at home, and I wrote most of them. There's a couple covers, but I wrote almost all of them, and just tried to start learning to go very quickly from inception to recording to completion to distribution, and that has now become a pattern that I'm familiar with, and I like that. And it's kind of fun because I can do sort of one-off songs that I would never put on an album. I did my favorite out of those. My two favorites are the theme song for the movie Zombie Cheerleading Camp, which I was asked to do. I don't know who thought they should ask me to write a song for Zombie Cheerleading Camp, but they did. And you can't say no when someone asks you that. So I wrote a punk song, actually. You played with my heart. You messed with my head. You sunk in your teeth and you left me for dead. Back then I was weak. Now I got me some guts. So boy, you better. Usually my music is kind of folky and pretty mellow, sometimes kind of funky, but definitely not punk. So this is my first journey into punk music.
And how about the new album that will be released on the internet, I understand?
That album is written about, strange as it sounds, it's songs that are written about the TV shows Firefly and Battlestar Galactica, but you would never know it to listen to them. And to me, actually, those worlds are very like Alaska. So it's kind of songs about frontier living and the characters you meet and the situations you encounter. I bought my own condenser microphone, so I can do that sort of independent musician thing of recording wherever you have time and space. I've recorded in people's closets. I have recorded at strangers' houses, in little sheds, out in remote areas, just anywhere that we can get high quality sound. And that has been so much fun, actually. I mean, I'm pretty tired, but I am going to be very proud of this project, especially as it comes out of the mixing and mastering process sounding all professional, but you know that you were in your friend's closet sitting on the floor while a fiddler stood over you and you were all cramped together, but you were getting some terrific music.
Oh, my darling, there is something we must discuss. How with cell phone in hand you ran my Volvo through the special bus. And I am more a Volvo than any other kind of car. Reliable and safe and Scandinavian and square.
And that's AK for this week. We had help from Jay Marble on Prince of Wales Island, KUCB's Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and APRN's Lori Townsend and Annie Fite in Anchorage. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the text rundown for the show. While you're there, sign up for our free podcast, check out past shows, and send us an email to let us know how we're doing. You can also email us directly at ak@aprn.org. AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reported from Sitka, Scott Burton from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Jessica Cochran. Join us again next week.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK.
To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.